Well, good afternoon, everyone. Welcome to another News and Focus program. I've got two articles that I want to compare and contrast with you. One is written by Paul Craig Roberts, America's Descent into Poverty. America's Descent into Poverty. And the other one is an op-ed piece also coming to us from, and let me give you a look right now, it's called Inescapable Fact About Poverty, Carolina Journal Online. Carolina Journal Online. It's written by John Hood. So let's look at the first one. The United States has collapsed economically, socially, politically, legally, constitutionally, and environmentally. I'm reading from Roberts. The country that exists today is not even the shell of the country in which I was born. In this article, I will deal with America's economic collapse. In subsequent articles, I will deal with other aspects of America's collapse. Economically, America has descended into poverty. Peter Eldman says low wage work is pandemic. Today, freedom and democracy, America, the world's only superpower, 1/4 of the workforce is employed in jobs that are paying less than $22,000, the poverty line for a family of four. Some of these low-paid persons are young college graduates burdened by other educational loans who share housing with three or four others in the same desperate situation. Others of these persons are single parents, only one medical problem or a lost job away from homelessness. Others might be PhDs teaching at universities as adjunct professors for $10,000 per year or less. Education is still touted as the way out of poverty, but increasingly it is a path into poverty or enlistments into the military service. Well, that's isn't that interesting how the author reveals his bias by comparing enlistments into the military service and the path to poverty? Eldman, who studies these issues, reports that 20 million Americans have incomes less than $9,500 per year, which is half of poverty definition for a family of three. There are 6 million Americans whose only income is food stamps. That means that there are 6 million Americans who live on the streets or under bridges or in homes or of relatives or friends. Hard-hearted Republicans continue to rail at welfare, but Eldman says basically welfare is gone. Well, that's an interesting perspective to suggest that basically welfare is gone. I'm not sure how we can come to the conclusion that basically welfare is gone with 110 million people in America receiving some type of means-tested welfare. But you see, you have to know the facts in order to properly assess what's going on here. Welfare is gone. 1 out of 3 Americans receive some kind of government assistance, and that is now defined as gone. In my opinion, as an economist, the official poverty line is long out of date. The prospect of 3 people living on $19,000 per year is far-fetched, considering the price of rent, electricity, water, bread, fast food. One person cannot live in the United States on $6,333. Well, again, it's a wrong bias. I mean, it's a completely mixed perspective to cut the number by 3 and do it like that. Dan Airey, Duke University, Mike Norton, Harvard University have shown empirically 40% of the U.S. population, the 40 less well-off own only 0.3%. That is 0.3% of America's personal wealth. Who owns the other 99.7%? The top 20% have 84% of the country's wealth. Those Americans in the third and fourth quintiles, essentially America's middle class, have only 15% of the nation's wealth. Well, I mean, this is not something that's startling. As long as we live in a nation in which somebody can invent a thing called Facebook and make billions of dollars in computers and Apple, and you're going to have this. There's no other way around that. As long as you have a scenario where a guy can play baseball and football and he gets paid in the millions of dollars, you're going to have this income off-base kind of a distribution, which is what's being suggested here. In my day, confronted with such disparity in distribution of income and wealth, a disparity that obviously poses a dramatic problem for economic policy, political stability, and the macro management of the economy, Democrats would have demanded corrections and Republicans would have reluctantly agreed. But not today. Both political parties whore for money. The Republicans believe that suffering of poor Americans is not helping the rich enough. Well, I don't know what Republican believes that. I mean, I don't have any idea who is suggesting that your suffering is not helping the rich enough. Paul Ryan and Mitt Romney are committed to abolishing every program that addresses needs of what Republicans deride as useless eaters. Again, that's just a completely false statement. Paul Ryan and Mitt Romney are not committed to abolishing every program that addresses needs of what Republicans deride as useless eaters. The useless eaters are working poor and former middle class whose jobs were offshored so that corporate executives could receive multi-millions of dollars in performance pay compensation and their shareholders could make millions of dollars on capital gains while a handful of executives enjoy yachts and Playboy mates. Tens of millions of Americans barely get by. Again, another paragraph that is just packed with falsehoods. Do they not understand that these shareholders that they're making reference to are many, many of them are middle class Americans? Does he not understand, or does he refuse to consider the idea that the unions contributed to one of the problems with regard to the offshore movement of jobs? I mean, the insisting that I make $40 an hour when I don't even have an education and all I do is and then pick the manual thing, and then a company can go overseas and get the same person to do that same job for $3 an hour. Who's kidding who? We're competing in a global environment, a global environment. And how is it that some can make it and some can't? The concentration, and what I mean by that, let me unpack that just a little bit more. Why is it that Honda can come over here and make a great car? Why is it that the Honda can make a great car here in America without the unions? How's that working? Because we were told that they have to have the unions and et cetera, and it's just not the case. This article is presenting such a slanted perspective. So I want to pull up another one in just a minute. The political propaganda, the useless eaters, are not merely a burden on society and the rich. They are leeches who force honest taxpayers to pay for their many hours of comfortable leisure, enjoying life, watching sports, fishing, and trout swims while they push around their belongings in grocery baskets or sell their bodies for the next McDonald's burger. Again, just another incredible statement. So, can we find any balance with regard to this? Let's look at the inescapable fact about poverty written in the Daily Journal by John Hood, August 22, 2012. Another great article coming to us from Raleigh. If the chronic poverty were easy to prevent, it would not have become chronic in the first place. I'm not being flippant, John writes, about the problem. I'm arguing that before North Carolina lawmakers devise another round of policies aimed at reducing the poverty rate, they need to recognize why past efforts fell short of expectations. It wasn't because federal, state, and local governments failed to spend big money on means-tested programs. They spent and spent and spent big money on such programs. Hundreds of billions of dollars a year, according to the Cato Institute's latest tally. There is plenty of room for debate about the design and effectiveness of these programs. Most of the tax money flows into in-kind benefits such as Medicaid and public housing, for example. SNAP would be another example of that, rather than cash grants. Perhaps the mix ought to be different. My point is simply that the nation's welfare system is already very expensive. Some politicians and analysts believe that there would have been larger reductions in poverty over time had government spent fewer tax dollars on public assistance and more tax dollars on building and building physical and human capital to make the work of low-income Americans more valuable and thus better remunerated on the marketplace. I tend to agree. But that strategy alone would still have missed a big part of the problem. All right, now we're going to get into some thoughts from John. The inescapable fact about poverty, particularly the chronic poverty that has so long resisted any change by government intervention, is highly associated with self-destructive behavior, and that is precisely what our previous article did not even consider, is this self-destructive behavior. John writes, when people graduate from high school, work full-time, wait until marriage before having children, and avoid alcohol and drug addictions, the likelihood they will spend any significant time in poverty is minuscule, less than 2%. The vast majority of those working sober, married high school graduates will spend most of their lives living in households with incomes near or above the nation's median income. On the other hand, for every deviation from these basic rules of upward mobility, a household increases its risk of being in poverty. Violate all of these rules, and your chances of living in poverty rise to nearly 80%. Now, let's go over the rules. Rule number one, graduate from high school. Rule number two, work a full-time job or two part-time jobs or three part-time jobs. Rule number three, wait until marriage before having children. Rule number four, avoid alcohol and drug addictions. Avoid alcohol and drug addictions. And I might add, John doesn't, but I might add, avoid expensive tobacco products. On the other hand, for every deviation from these basic rules of upward mobility, a household increases its risk of being in poverty, he says, by, if you violate them all, 80%. These are facts. They are not assertions or statistical quirks. But how many politicians and analysts respond to these facts can be most revealing. Some respond angrily that such talk constitutes blaming the victim. Others throw up their hands and say that the poor people deserve what happens to them. Still others accept these facts and then start trying to design government program that discourages out-of-wedlock births and encourages unmarried parents to wed. So let me give you an example of a program that could be designed appropriately. Imagine you have two tiers of welfare, and one tier is at level one, and level one is less than level two, but in order to get to level two, you have to have a high school diploma. You have to have a high school diploma. Now, think about the means by which you're doing everything you can to discourage this unproductive behavior. Or we could reverse it, and we could say that married couples receive more WICA or WIC or SNAP or benefits than unmarried couples with regard to tax deductions or assistance. But we've got to do something to encourage the behavior that we want and discourage the behavior that we don't want. And oh, by the way, that is biblical. None of these responses is sufficient to the task, it seems to me. When we observe that young people often make poor decisions that affect the course of their lives, we are not blaming the victim. We are recognizing something basic about human beings, that we are flawed creatures who make mistakes, particularly when we lack experience, information, and long-term perspective, as teenagers so often do. Throwing up our hands won't cut it either, like it or not. When young people make self-destructive choices, the consequences are not limited to themselves. They impose a burden on relatives, coworkers, neighbors, and taxpayers. The welfare state is not going to disappear tomorrow. If people make better decisions in their youth, there would be fewer children growing up without fathers or mothers, fewer unemployable young adults, fewer addicts needing treatment, fewer people receiving government handouts. And oh, by the way, that is the goal, isn't it? I should hope it is. In so much as the fact that we're borrowing 40 cents of every dollar we spend, so it's not as though we have money to give away. Still, recognizing that it would be beneficial to reduce behavior-related poverty is not to establish that Congress or the state legislation can pass a few laws and accomplish the task. Reforming our education, substance abuse, and welfare policies will require patience and fortitude, and no government program will be ever able to make successful marriages out of troubled relationships. Preventing chronic poverty in the future means changing minds and hearts today. And this is what he says. This is a very good closing line. That is primarily the job for family, friends, and faith, not politics. So there you go. There you have it. Another rule, another program, another policy is not going to make the difference. Christ will make the difference. The gospel will make the difference. The family will make the difference. And even good friends that guide teenagers to abstain from sexual relationships, abstain from alcohol use, abstain from drug use, abstain from dropping out of school, get a job, stay in that job. These are basic things that seem to be ignored. And why in the world would you get a job if you can collect 99 weeks of unemployment? And then where's your motivation going to be to go back to the workforce if you've had almost 2 years of doing nothing? We've got major problems in our nation, and we're ignoring the contribution that self-destructive behavior makes to the poverty. We're just ignoring that, and we're putting band-aids on the problem instead of stopping the bleeding. Well, thanks for having time to listen to this. Post your comments directly to sermonaudio.com right here on this program. Have a great weekend.